Okay, so I'm here with Adam Ross, who is the author of Mr. Peanut. Adam, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks.
I wanted to first of all start at the beginning. You have given us at least three narratives to work from here. We have, of course, the initial chronicle where Pepin describes what's happening with his wife. The second chronicle involving the detectives looking into Alice's murder, where we get into Haystroll. The third chronicle involving Sam Shepard, of course. So the question I have is, where does the narrative begin? I mean, what primary entry point is there? Or is there even a primary entry point? I'll go into theories about this further, but I wanted to start here.
Actually, I think that's a great question, because really the way in which Mr. Peanut's designed is to in some ways have no real entry point. I mean, if the book's form as a Mobius strip, actually works, which is, of course, you know, subject to anybody's opinion, whether they are mesmerized by it or whether they want to throw it across the room, you should actually be able to pick it up anywhere. You should be able to start in the middle, or you should be able to start in the end, because really the book loops back to the beginning at the end. I mean, I think in terms of, if I would say I believe with beginning with a bang, then I mean, really the book's beginning is with fantasy and with how David, for whatever set of reasons, or, you know, because of whatever kind of marital discord, imagines his wife disappearing from his life, either via convenient acts of God or by more violent forms of accident, then the book really begins where it begins, because the book's about being careful what you wish for.
Yeah. You name-check Calvino's Invisible Cities near the end, and there's also the insinuation by some of the characters that what is really unfolding here is something that involves parallel narratives.
Right.
On the other hand, well, I know I wanted to read that and compartmentalize it and to split it up, but also simultaneously view it as a sort of almost a parallel set. And I'm wondering if one can even do that with a book from a reading standpoint. And I'm also curious if some of the parallel narratives came into place perhaps, like, you know, midway through the writing of the book.
Let me start this way. I mean, I think that to me, in terms of, if we talk about a book that is an example of parallel narratives that may be, and I don't mean this critically, but sort of weakly come together or are weakly bound, you would consider a book like The Hours by Michael Cunningham, where really you do have, parallel narratives about different women characters that at the very end are very loosely bridged by this one character who was a child in an earlier narrative becoming an adult in a later narrative. But, part of the struggle for me in writing the book, and part of what I really wanted to do, was to, in fact, not have a book that worked that way, but really show by the end why all these characters are there. Now, to me, we run the risk of spoiler alert, but really in the book's like last 35 pages, I make it as clear as I think I am comfortable making it, you know, about why you have inhabited the consciousness of these detectives, and why David, in his own book, was, as it were, exploring other consciousnesses vis-a-vis his own guilty thoughts about the demise of his wife.
Yeah.
So it is, to me, it's unified. To me, the book is, you are racing toward not only sort of the MacGuffin answer, which is, did David kill his wife or not, but also, what are these people doing here? Because, for instance, in the case of Shepard, as Cacatani pointed out in her review, he would be, if this was naturalist, realist fiction, he would be in his 80s.
Yeah.
But this is a book about a computer game designer who traffics in avatars. And that, to me, is what this book's about. And that's actually something that, I really do hope that at some point more critics start to deal with, because I think the thing that's interesting about David, and the thing that I find really troubling about David and the way he's emblematic of a lot of modern characters, is that I think he encounters life better by way of avatars than he does with what's right in front of him. And we live in a world, my friend, where I've seen many a parent pushing their kid on the swing while staring at a PDA or gazing at Facebook. I mean, we live in a world where the virtual is constantly creeping up into the real, and that really interests me.
Well, there's a line where you have David say there's something about hard copy that a screen can never convey. And what we have in this book is a situation in which you are asking people to believe in multiple realities and even realities beyond those realities. I mean, Australia, to my mind, suggested Oz. And, of course, the fact that David's wife is named Alice should be a dead giveaway that all this is illusory. Well, if all this is illusory, then if there's no real tangible entry point, if we are, in fact, caught in a video game like David, something by design, then what is the purpose of fiction? Or is it because we should just go ahead and accept the novel as artifice, that that is its kind of advantage over a screen, that is less complicated, that is less open to possibilities?
You put your finger on something that I was recently talking with a former colleague about, which is, there's that line, you know, art was no exorcism, at least not for the artist. And I think one of the things that I'm really interested in thematically is, you know, the oldest question about, you know, the Western canon and the sort of traditional education in the arts, you know, the moral education of the, you know, of the reader. Do reading these great works make us better people? I'm a guy who, just like David in the book, had this terrific education, for instance, in the work of Alfred Hitchcock, who is a very moral filmmaker. But I was an A++ student in Hitchcock. But did that make me a better person? Yes and no. It did not make me invulnerable to mistakes, to moral lapses, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So that's one thing I'm investigating. But going to your more immediate question, I do think that there is a very clear, the part of the book that is absolutely real is about David. And I'm being very specific with the names there.
Yeah.
David is real. Alice is real. I think the reader, in order to, as it were, separate out some of these skeins of reality, the reader has to ask him or herself, how did Alice die? And if once you make that decision about how Alice actually died, I think the book, in a kind of choose your path way, not unravels, but clarifies. At the same time, the book is designed as a Mobius strip wherein the narrative itself, and that's the relationship between David and the character he's writing, Pepin, and Pepin, the character he's writing named David, are on a Mobius strip, and it's inescapable. I sort of like to think of Mr. Peanut as David's greatest video game, because he created, as it were, the inverse of Escher Exit, where there's no exit.
But I should also point out that, to me, your book reminded me very much of Samuel Delaney's Dahlgren, largely because it also has a loop structure. Mobius might also be the kid. We see about 60 pages in, the first lines of the book in the manuscript are repeated, which is done in Dahlgren as well. And essentially, you've replaced the Greek and Roman mythological references with Hitchcock references throughout, which I'll get into in a bit. So the question is to what degree was Dahlgren an influence upon writing this book? And is it your suggestion, by replacing our classical mythology that was laid down years ago by Delaney with cinematic images, that our culture is getting a little bit more retrograde, that this is the only way with which to capture a kind of loop structure as you have in this book?
Well, first of all, the work Dahlgren that you're referring to, I don't know it.
Really?
Don't know it at all.
Oh my God.
Who's it by?
Samuel Delaney.
I don't know it.
You don't know Samuel Delaney?
Mm-mm.
Oh, wow. You should totally read it. It's like
very
science fiction, experimental.
It has
a very similar structure, and it even has a third section that goes on forever, mm-hmm. just as the Sam Shepard one goes on quite long as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, to me, to answer, though, your question about retrograde culture, as it were, yes. I mean, I think the book is trying to examine now that tension between the virtual, which you see plenty of people right now arguing is, you know, just as, you know, just as advanced and complex a kind of narrative structure, virtual narrative vis-a-vis video games, as the literary. I don't agree. I don't agree also because there's an element in gaming per se of terminus and where there's not in the book. And I think what David is trying to investigate or trying to deal with, and this is where the book becomes very, very ironic, is he's trying to wake himself up to life by way of the virtual. And so the question is, isn't that sort of a permanent kind of spiral? Isn't that a permanent spiraling away from life? And I see that everywhere I turn right now, which is that it seems to me that look at the events that we're suffering from right now in this country. You know, I don't know whether to think we're a terrific nation because more bankers haven't been dragged out of their Park Avenue apartments and, like, you know, drawn and quartered, or BP executives, et cetera, or, you know, politicians sending young men and women to war. We seem to be at such a distance from things that used to have us running out on the streets.
Yeah.
Even though, in fact, ironically, paradoxically, they're played out before us on a continuous strip.
Yeah.
That seems to, in some way, buffer us or distance us from what is what is impacting us at every level of our existence.
Yeah.
And so that, to me, in some ways, is one of the novel's sort of major concerns. But it's situated within the institution that, in some ways, is the foundation of our society.
But also with Otto in this book near the end,
mm-hmm.
you have him actively discouraging his audience of students and also the reader who is there in the classroom with him.
Check.
To look for semiotics, to look for symbols, to look for the numerous elliptical objects that are placed throughout the book. I mean, I don't think there's a page in this book that doesn't have something circular in it.
Absolutely.
And so, on one hand, you're inviting people not to plunge in deeper, but if you are also creating a series of semiotics that is intended to be unraveled, that is intended to be, I suppose, straightened out. Isn't that, is this more of an irony, or is this more of a sort of statement upon just perception, as you say, this circular perception?
Well, grounding those observations and questions in the novel itself, I think that what keeps us going day in and day out, as we live our lives, and certainly as we live our lives as members, hopefully, of, you know, caring relationships, is the belief that we can improve and change. And when I think of the idea of change, progress, the improvability of character, that to me is a belief that character is somewhat linear, right? That, like, okay, I learned that lesson back then, and I'm never going to do it again. And yet, my experience as a guy who's been successfully married for 15 years is that the experience of living with someone you care about a great deal for a long period of time is to be joyfully, to come up against the reef of circularity, but also to enjoy, the bliss of recurrence, right? Of things going. So there are these competing, it's paradoxical, there are these competing desires. There's the closed circles that Mr. Peanut presents, the entrapment, which is the same experience, I think, of looking at Escher's, which is that weird, like, you look at the art object from outside, and if you really enter an Escher, you have this perceptual experience where it's like inescapable, and then you have to step back.
Yeah,
is to me kind of analogous to the experience we often feel with our those closest to us, which is we want, whether it's brothers, sisters, mothers, fathers, or husbands, wives, we want to believe that we could get past X.
Yeah.
But we often don't. And that to me is the heaven and hell of that's the heaven and hell of marriage.
Yeah. So what you are suggesting here,
I'm suggesting tension.
Yeah.
I'm suggesting a tension between those two.
Well, that's true. But you're also suggesting that by David embarking on this manuscript of looking at his marriage from the outside, and then also actively discouraging himself, so to speak,
check,
to look at the actual symbols,
check,
and everything that lines up, that's really the dilemma that you're actually laying down here. And then simultaneously, you add an additional meta element by bringing the reader involved, because then the reader is looking from the outside, from the outside,
yes,
from the outside.
Well, let's go back. Okay, because you're really... There's nothing better to me as the writer than having this kind of a conversation, because you're putting your finger exactly onto me what I was trying to examine.
Yeah.
And so the first question I would say in terms of decoding some aspects of Mr. Peanut is this, you know, when is David writing this? Because essentially the book hints that there was a period of him being terribly blocked, and then there's a period where he is liberated to close the circle,
yeah,
or close the Mobius band, right? At the same time, it is to me powerful works of art. A movie that comes to mind just off the top of my head is either something like Nicholas Roeg's Don't Look Now, or the movie Francis, the great movie Francis with Jessica Lange, where the effect of the work is to shock you and stun you. Another book like this would be John Hawkes's The Lime Twig, where the power of the nightmare is forceful enough that you emerge from it, you know, not just still reeling from the things you've seen, but also hopefully more awake to what's right in front of you in the real.
Yeah.
And so that, you know, I mean, the question is, can art, is the virtual a prophylactic from life, or does it have this possible saving power? Does a reader who I bring in, and as you say, look from the outside in at all these moments that are fraught with conflict, violence, and moments of joy and missed opportunities, is the reader thereby more awake to his or her life, or is it just another entertainment? Is it just another enchantment? I don't have the answer to that. My hope would be that it's a wake-up call.
Yeah.
My experience is that these wake-up calls, that we're on the band also, that we're constantly forgetting.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
No, it totally does. And actually, I just wanted to lay out just a sampling of the numerous Hitchcock references in this book to jump off at this point. I mean,
sure,
you have, for example, Nurse Ritter, referenced to,
sure,
Thelma Ritter in Rear Window. David encounters business cards made out to Dr. Fred Richmond from Psycho, Dr. Alex Bruloff from Spellbound, which is also the name of his software company. Jessalyn Fax is a co-worker of Alice's, but also the actress who have played Miss Hearing Aid in Rear Window,
yes,
and so on. So I'm wondering, based off of your last answer, whether there was a specific science in these particular references, or whether they were all pure MacGuffins, pure ways of detracting the reader, of inviting the reader to look in at something, again, going back to the question of semiotics, that is either complete bullshit, or whether there actually is any kind of remote justification, or whether it was just you having fun. And again, it works on this level of, here, reader, look from the outside, but if you peer in, you will find nothing.
I've been watching Hitchcock films intensively for 20 years.
Yeah.
And it would be pure postmodern kitsch, pure postmodern trash, if those references didn't have, as it were, a kind of, they didn't rhyme thematically.
Yeah.
In fact, there is throughout the novel, a semiotics of naming.
Yeah.
Which you've already put your finger on. And with some of the names you've already brought up, for instance, the characters in, I mean, Ward Hastrell is an anagram for Lars Thorwald.
Yeah.
So I mean, it's the Hastrell section in terms of the way names are used, And not just names, but they're the Escher obverse of Rear Window. So for instance, and I'll only give a few of these away, but to give you an idea that there's method to the madness, I mean, the Newlyweds that Ward Hastrell interviews are named, are the same actors in Rear Window. And if you go through, it actually, in some ways, it, for instance, in that case, it modernizes the conflict that the couple has in Rear Window. Ross Bagdasarian is the name of the piano player in Rear Window, and we get a, and his wife, that's Judith, he says, is the woman who is ultimately Miss Lonely Hearts.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they clearly, in that one quick cameo that Ross Bagdasarian has, they've had a happy life, but now he's their life is fading from memory because of his Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
So there's that. There is this superstructure. But more importantly, in the Shepherd section, I wouldn't want to give too much of this away because I'm waiting for people like yourself to start really dealing with it. The Shepherd section is comprised, both in terms of content and certain kinds of rhyming themes, of multiple Hitchcock narratives. Vertigo plays an enormous part, both in terms of content and thematically, in the Shepherd section. Shadow of a Doubt, Strangers on a Train, Marnie, Rear Window, to name but a few. Spellbound, as you said, does reemerge. I could go on.
Yeah.
But the North by Northwest, which is also has its own very clear semiotics of the kind of spy action caper, because I think Hitchcock at that time was very tired of the action caper MacGuffin and wanted to introduce an element of absurdity. So, for instance, Cary Grant's wallet in North by Northwest, his teeny little wallet never empties of money, and he's constantly doling out cash throughout the whole film. Little tricks like that. You know, a Hitchcock scholar will start to enter that labyrinth and start to see in the way in which these themes, even on the level of mise-en-scène, I mean, if you look at the way certain characters are dressed in the Shepherd section and where they go to buy clothes, it is not just using Hitchcock locales and settings, but it is also the birds, for instance, Highway 1. But it is also dealing with some themes in Hitchcock that are central to me. Themes of fallen people, themes of idleness, themes of male anxiety vis-a-vis women, and the controlling gaze of men. To me, one of the most terrifying Hitchcock films is Vertigo. To me, the violence that Jimmy Stewart inflicts upon Kim Novak in Vertigo, to this day, I find hard to watch. And it's amazing. You want to talk about a movie that anticipated some of the things I'm talking about with respect to avatars and virtual reality. Jimmy Stewart in Vertigo falls in love with a constructed character who is herself pretending to be possessed by a constructed character. So there's a double level of reality. He meets the real woman and then proceeds to recreate this, in this like nightmarish version of Pygmalion, this character who does not exist, overlaying this phantom onto this real woman who is also thinks she's in love with him. Look, the level of projections are practically like, it's like echolalia and infinite regression.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? But that's why that stuff is there. And it didn't, the reason this novel took so long to construct, it's not as intertextual as something like Lolita or something like Ulysses, but it is absolutely hyper-intertextual. So there's method to the madness.
This makes me want to ask you about the way, often eccentrically, that you describe penises throughout the book. It's almost as if Hitchcock, by way of coming 50 years later, no pun intended, actually now has the ability to describe what's on his mind. Just to give you some examples, I mean, you have little boy Ralph, his penis looks like the Michelin Man. Marilyn Shepherd, or Hoverston, attempts to seduce Marilyn Shepherd, and you write that his erect cock listed right like an inchworm reaching for the leaf. David offers his rundown of stereotypical penises, and the phrase a panopticon of penises is introduced. It's almost as if the organic tool itself to talk about this lust is just rendered so absurd by these descriptions. I'm curious about this in relation to your last answer, this melange of various plots that Hitchcock used. What of this? Was it just you having fun, or is there some credits to my...
First of all, part of it is having fun. A really close friend of mine, his favorite passage in the book is the YMCA businessman's club scene where, I'm comfortable enough to tell you that that it's purely autobiographical. There's, nothing like walking through a locker room and being like, oh my goodness, what many shapes and forms this thing comes in. But also, you're absolutely right. Let's take, for instance, the way Brian De Palma took some of these Hitchcockian tropes and approaches, and essentially, given the liberty of the late 70s through early 80s, was able to then take these ideas of the male gaze and anxiety and inject them with their sort of pornographic implications.
Yeah. Right?
To me, what I'm doing is I'm taking male anxiety and male myopia with the member itself.
Yeah.
Because it's the ultimate sort of one-eyed thing. And playing with it. I mean, again, I'm a big another philosophical underpinning of the novel is the moral philosophy of Immanuel Levinas and the idea of the other as an infinite.
Yeah.
The idea that to dumb it down, the person that we encounter on a day-to-day basis constantly outstrips us and is beyond our grasp. And any attempt to sort of say, and again, this is really, really dumbing it down, but I know that person is a form of, kind of totalizing violence. That's what all the men in frustration do with their significant others, or that totalizing tendency is a way of them, as it were, sort of writing off the existence of their spouses in order to justify morally hazardous behavior.
Yeah. Well, at the same time, I wanted to go back to the idea of why you use...
Let's go back to Cock.
Yeah. Why you use the Hitchcock references in lieu of classical references. I mean, for example, you have the point where Eberling is desperately flipping through the books. He stumbles onto Ovid's The Art of Love. And you say that he's flipping through the pages, but that section you quote from is right from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
You claim that he flips through the pages. There's Dr. Otto and his chicken theory,
mm-hmm.
which is an extremely batty and simplistic way, again, going back to this idea that it's almost defying the reader's desire to look at the semiotics. Are you suggesting with, for example, the Eberling moment that... if the reader plunges further, they could transform into that sort of unthinking Eberling type who's just randomly grabbing any book around or any theory around or any kind of meaning from this. It's a risky proposition, particularly if you're also inviting the reader to really look into the Shepherd section as a series of tropes. So... I'm wondering how you reconcile this, or is it reconciled by the nature of the Mobius strip?
Let's simplify this a little and agree on some basic terms. Because our conversation right now is really, and I love these kinds of conversations, but it's really highfalutin. But really, to me, there's actually a very simple story here, and it's the story of missed opportunity. It's the story of a man and a woman who, because of tragedy and miscommunication, became so distant from each other that they lost each other, which to me is about as common, or at least 50% of marriages. It's about as common a story as there is, okay? But in terms of, so there's that. On an interpretive level, or what you're getting at with Hitchcock, again, there's really a sort of simple answer. David, in trying to understand how he missed the boat, how he missed the train with his wife, goes back to their beginning, which I think in crisis we do all the time, to recover joy. And where did they first meet? They first met in a pair of classes. One was a Hitchcock class, where they sat together and they discussed the very kinds of Hitchcockian themes and tropes and fell in love. And they met also in a feminist theory class, where they talked about the dawn of the sexual and feminist revolution, and by way of primarily some of Hitchcock's themes and the Shepherd case, because there's that interesting conjunction that just when the Shepherd case was occurring, so too were that summer was the same summer that Rear Window came out, right? I don't think one of the amazing things to me about Rear Window is that the conflicts that Hitchcock delineates in Rear Window are really not that much different from some of the slings and arrows modern marriage suffers right now. Men and women being on different levels of success. You know, Grace Kelly in Rear Window being really essentially more successful professionally, financially,
yeah,
socially than Jimmy Stewart in the movie.
But even the concluding moment of that movie that always has bothered me, where she puts the book aside and reads the magazine.
Well, and so there's the question, though, and then you talk about semiotics. The question is, you talk about a semiotic question.
Yeah.
The question is she really changing, or is she just putting on the semiotics of the tough, rough and tumble gal? I mean, are we to really believe that given what Jimmy and Grace have gone through, they haven't changed? Well, there at the very end, Hitchcock throws that wrench in and says, no, you see, look out the window. All relationships are cyclical. Miss Lonely Hearts has gone from suicide to salvation. The songwriter has gone from a writer's block to completed composition. The dog people have bought a new dog and have started over. The newlyweds, who've been fucking for a week, are now like pissed off at each other and already on their way to becoming the Thorwalds.
Yeah.
Do you see what I'm saying? There's that tension again between linearity and circularity. So I'm making observations here, but I guess what I'm not sure of is, on an interpretive level, given some of the things I've laid out, I'm not sure I understand how Mr. Peanut is stiff-arming you in terms of interpretation.
What I'm getting at is the struggle here between upbraiding the reader or upbraiding David for looking too much into the details while simultaneously presenting the details. That's what I'm trying to examine here.
Well, when you say upbraiding, I would actually like to think, gosh, I would hope.
Yeah.
I mean, what I wanted to design was a book really like Psycho. Mm-hmm. Because I wanted to write something that on the initial reading had such a strong MacGuffin and was essentially a page turner. And I think in a lot of cases, if you look at the reaction to the book, a lot of people found it, you know, mesmerizing, gripping. They ripped through it.
Yeah.
And then you learn some things at the end that completely reorganize the beginning.
Sure.
The amazing thing to me about a movie like Psycho is that once you get to the end of that film, you watch that movie from beginning to end again, and Hitchcock knew that you could never watch that movie the same way because of how he'd exploded your relationship to Marion Crane, right? So it becomes like a comedy. I mean, there's so many in-jokes throughout the film, and then suddenly the use of mirrors in the film becomes kind of hysterical. The implication about Norman's like homosexuality, and Hitchcock was very, I think, really in a kind of unevolved way, saw all homosexuality as a form of, you know, deviance, potentially leaning toward the violent, blah, blah, blah. Which obviously I don't agree with, but that's what he was playing with. And so that's what I was trying to, that's what I was trying to do. So what I was trying to do was reward that next level of exploration. And then once you get through Mr. Peanut, you start looking at these things on a, as it were, sort of pixelated way. And you start breaking it down. And then, but then the question is, are you in the trap? Like, are you, you know, here you are spending all this time, like, hyper-investigating this work of art. Like, are you... Is there a reward there?
Yeah. Well, this would also lead me to ask you about the long and difficult middle, which we haven't talked about.
Please.
Constant.
That's an idea, by the way, from Conrad. I mean, like, I first encountered that idea in reading Conrad, who talked about the modern novel as something that almost uncontrollably swelled from the middle. But go ahead.
Well, the Shepherd section is quite long, and we're prepared for that with the very extended Hawaii section that comes right before it. I'm wondering if that had actually been longer in an original draft, or whether it had always been designed at length than it is. Because it demands a considerable amount of time investment from the reader. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious as to why you took that particular risk with that section.
Well,
in terms of length.
Sure. I mean, in early drafts, it was actually shorter. But I felt like you could not really... the mystery of the Shepherd case was ill-served if you didn't really delve into Shepherd's relationship with Susan Hayes and that period of time, mere months before the murder of Marilyn, that he spent with her in Los Angeles, which is all true, which is all based on historical fact. Obviously, I imagine into some of these events, and obviously there's poetic license, don't get me wrong. But... to be honest, I was just having a ball, first of all. I mean, to me, just like in some ways, I was kind of having a ball with the Hawaii section. I mean, the Shepherd section to me becomes, particularly when you get to the end, if you believe Shepherd is innocent, okay? And I'm not saying he is, because I do not take a position on whether or not Shepherd is innocent. You have to see that there's just very obvious parallels between Shepherd and David's life. In both cases, you had characters who were really late arrivals to the joy that was right in front of them. And so I'll put it to you this way. To me, in the Shepherd character, David finds the most tragic avatar he can to really explore his own guilt about the loss of his own wife.
The question of poetic license intrigues me. For example, there's this scenario where Eberling blames his foster mother for his life. And I'm guessing that was poetic license. I'm pretty sure that was poetic license. The question I have is, these people have been dead for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And
actually, Susan Hayes is still alive.
Susan Hayes, okay. Susan Hayes is still alive. But I'm wondering if... Did you feel that you were really honoring them by this notion of placing them... placing what certain facts that you determined and then aligning them with the Hitchcock tropes and whatever poetic ideas came your way while you were writing that?
That's a really good question. First of all, I was really very thorough in my research. I read everything I could get my hands on with respect to Shepherd so that I had, you know, a real command of the facts of the case. There are, as in any case like this, yes, there's a degree of warping here and there. You know, the conversation, for instance, between Marilyn and Hoverston is invented. You know, the consciousness of Hoverston is completely invented, although I personally find it suspicious in ways that blow my mind that Lester Hoverston was playing golf, and this is a fact, with Dr. Robert Stevenson, who was Susan Hayes' ex-fiance the night that Marilyn was killed. It blows my mind. Because at the time, Hoverston was never treated as a suspect. He was merely treated as essentially character witness against Shepherd. And he sold Shepherd up the river, by the way, in the trial. I mean, once he got before a grand jury and the actual jury trial, I mean, he fingered all kinds of infidelities of shepherds. So I wanted to know the facts of the case, but just as, you know, just as when we look at, you know, when we look at certain things in the run-up to the Iraq War, we see certain kinds of like Shakespearean parallels or classical, you know, parallels, you know, the Cassandra myth, for instance, blah, blah, you know, like all the Cassandras that weren't listened to. I mean, yes, there's license there because I think that in the Shepherd story, given literary treatment, you have a character who, given the right treatment, or at least I hope the right treatment, touches on the universal. And that universal, that mythic element is how dangerous ambivalence is when it comes to those closest to us, or in the case of Shepherd, and this is what really, honestly, this is what makes him a caution, is how, if he is innocent, or if he was innocent, his behavior somehow may be, because we don't know, somehow may be brought these destructive elements closer to his wife.
Yeah.
You know? And if he didn't, if he did do it, then, my God, the lies he had to tell himself up until the end of his miserable existence after he was arrested. You know, what a, talk about the virtual eclipsing the real. If he killed Marilyn, he had to nearly freaking brainwash himself for the last, 14 years of his life, over and over. And if you read, for instance, Endure and Conquer, which is his autobiography, it's a pretty bad book.
As Mobius says.
Yeah, and it is. Yes. I mean, but it's like, you know, it's sort of a, it's poorly written. It was clearly written on the fly, but it's just him just constant. Not only is it him, you know, again, constantly affirming and reaffirming his innocence, but then it's this really sort of narcissistic spiral into his, you know, relationship with his second wife. And I don't know. He becomes, you read that and he's very unpalatable. So, I mean, that's a very meandering way of saying some of these, this melding or hybridizing of the Hitchcockian with the historical was, again, because I saw parallels in terms of the way Hitchcock talked about male anxiety, idleness, and fallen characters, and the way in which Shepherd and his wife's marriage played out to its very tragic, murderous conclusion.
I'm curious if you made any efforts to contact Susan Hayes.
No, and I'll tell you why. Because I wouldn't want to, living in that reality was so vivid that I don't want to hear there's a different reality.
Yeah.
And because, as is often the case, the real rarely makes a better story, as far as I'm concerned.
So you felt that by accumulating all the information from the books and all your research, just as with the Hitchcock, that this was a better way to find a Pepin-like reality that served your needs. I mean, I'm wondering if there's a certain risk of distorting the truth, or, I mean, this is the great irony of novels. I mean, we think novels are truer often than memoirs, which we insist upon verisimilitude for that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if the storehouse of information at your disposal was often too much, was often too real, or whether you required that considerably well-constructed house with which to sustain these sections.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, I'll put it to you this way, I think that we're talking about the difference between primary and secondary sources, and the secondary sources, the books, the narratives, the true crime, the sociological recountings, the legal recountings, they set me dreaming, as Flaubert likes to say.
Yeah.
A primary source could very well have stuck a needle through this butterfly that I was trying to make.
Yeah.
In a way that would have really limited my imagination. So, there was a better chance for, as it were, misremembering and bending some of these aspects of a real case to my purposes, I think, if I didn't talk to a primary source.
But it's fiction. You can distort a primary source. But do you find that an unethical proposition as a novelist? I'm curious.
That's a really interesting question. I think that I know that in the next novel, my book of short stories is coming out next summer. But in the next novel I'm working on, it's rooted in a lot of primary source material, both from autobiographical experience and just from it's about a kid whose father is a famous Broadway actor. My father was a Broadway actor, and in that case, I am definitely departing from primary source material, but again, making it a heck of a lot more interesting than it was actually. So, but to answer the question about ethics, they're different disciplines. I wasn't trying to do history. I was trying to do something a lot more mythic.
You needed a more abstract base with
Absolutely.
Which to form the novel.
Absolutely. Although, I mean, again, the novel, I mean, again, it's a matter of taste. I mean, like, for some people, the drifting between levels or environments in the novel, the shifting of tones and, you can use whatever term you want, people like that and feel like it's seamless. For other people, it's a mashup. I think that it's a question of taste. I just find that I find that on a day-to-day basis in this multimedia world, you can watch someone on the subway, go from reading Trollope on their lap to getting an email, going to the internet, watching a YouTube video, and then I think I'm going to play some Super Mario, and nobody seems to have a problem with that. So I think that reality as we live it right now is this crazy narrative mashup as well.
It seems to me you're both willing to give the reader the obvious liberty to use your book or read your book. Use your book. That's the problem right there. To read your book in any way she wants. But on the other hand, what's so wrong about someone who wishes to multitask or to read your book between Super Mario or whatnot? I mean, I'm wondering if maybe the reason, I'm just speculating here, I mean, you can jump off of this. The reason you wanted these long, sustained chapters, or sections rather, is to sort of challenge that notion of compartmentalized.
Yes. Well, now here's another thing. Here's another thing that, again, I'm hoping that, a critic out there will deal with, which is what Scott Turow talked about in his review, which is some of the fracturing that happens. That's really intentional. It may not always make for what we readers always want, which is uninterrupted dream, but at least in this book, I wanted to embrace the idea of moments of radical shift or fracturing to make a point, because let's bring the book back to what it's really about. It's about marriage and how over long periods of time people lose sight of each other, and it's a very insidious thing, because you can just be going about your business and realize that, this is even more of the case when you have kids, that you haven't had a real conversation with your husband or wife for weeks because you've just been going at it so hard in your respective universes. And you need one of those moments. Sometimes couples do it with fights. Sometimes they do it by going out to dinner, et cetera. You need those wake-up moments, right? That's part of what I'm trying to do there. And again, if some people want to say that it's a mashup and other people are like, yeah, I know what that's like all the time. I mean, they're certainly entitled.
Well, I think that's a good place to close. Adam, thanks so much for taking the time. It was a pleasure.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thanks.